What's going on, guys? Welcome back to the show. Today we have a Q&A episode, so thank you to everybody who asked a question. This was an anonymous Q&A, so occasionally we get a little bit of a weird question, but if it's funny, I'll read it out. If not, I'll just say weird question and we'll move on. I have not read any of those, and so let's see how many we can get through. We'll go for like 30, 45 minutes here. I say it every time, but we probably go through a lot more than that. So, first question. I swapped out squats as I have an achy knee. I brought in hip thrusts and now have achy hips. I've been lifting for years. Is this the price of turning 40? Laughing face, crying face. I don't think it's this simple. I'm not even sure I would swap out squats because you have an achy knee. I think, you know, part of having strong knees is doing stuff that works those joints and tendons and associated muscles. But doing them in a way that with good technique, with enough volume, you know, meeting yourself where you're at, not doing more than you're capable of doing at that point. So I'm not even sure I would swap out squats. I would want to dive deeper into what achy means. So yeah, I'm not even sure you have, you know, kind of like achy hips because of this, but I think what I would look at is how you're performing these movements. Make sure you have a coach. Maybe you're in my group, that is checking your technique and making sure you're doing things in a way that makes sense. And then I might take a look at the overall volume that you're doing. Maybe you're across your program, you're doing a lot of knee dominant stuff, a lot of split squatting, a lot of back squatting, a lot of leg pressing, a lot of hack squatting, a lot of, you know, knee flexion emphasis, which can be a good thing, but maybe you're just doing more than you can recover from right now. And maybe that's the adjustment I would make rather than, you know, swapping out squats altogether. And so I don't think this is the price of turning 40. I think as we age, we recover slower. That is true. So the amount of volume we can do and the frequency in which we can train does gently shift over time. I don't think there's a magic switch that happens at 30 or 40. And so, yeah, hopefully there was something there. I don't think that this is something where if you have achy something, you need to totally get rid of all the exercises that work that. But maybe you need to do less of them across your program, or, you know, have a little bit more rest days in your week, or do less sets, or train a little further from failure. But I would definitely make sure your technique is good before scrapping it. You know, next question says, yo, stop leaving me on red. See, this is what happens, you know? Oh, shit. Next question. Weird question. Well, not weird. Okay. Next one. Coaches say consistency over perfection, but if I'm being honest, I don't know what that means. It sounds like keep trying to be perfect. Can you help unpack this? Wow. I think I see where you're coming from, where like this sentiment of consistency over perfection sometimes is a bit nebulous. Like, what does that even mean? I think for me, when I read or when I would say, I'm sure I've said something to the effect of this, is that there is no goal outside of like professional athletes or bodybuilders. You know, and I'd even go as far as to say even those people, there's no goal that requires perfection. Something that jumps to mind to me is we have research that shows, you know, people who eat 80%, let's say, whole minimally processed foods versus people who eat 100% whole minimally processed foods have no difference in health outcomes. And so, you know, you'd say the 100% eating whole minimally processed foods is probably air quotes better, or maybe air quotes like perfect. But it didn't matter. Beyond 80%, it didn't matter. And so, you know, it's the same with like working out. You know, if you work out, let's say if you're trying to work out 4 times a week, that's 200 workouts a year. That's 2,000 workouts over the next 10 years, you know? And if you miss a workout here and there, and instead of 2,000 workouts over the next 10 years, you get 1,900 workouts over the next 10 years, I bet you you're in exactly the same place. But if you were trying to hold yourself to perfection and you needed to get, you know, the point is, if you are shooting for perfection and you don't meet it, you have a greater likelihood of saying F it, saying fuck it, and just doing nothing. But if you can get your mindset of consistency over perfection, you might allow that or have an understanding that, you know, doing something at 75%, 80%, 90% is either just as good or at least infinitely better than nothing. And so this consistency over perfection kind of mentality or sentiment is just an understanding that the goal that you have probably doesn't require 100% perfection. And so when life throws you a tornado, a whirlwind weekend where you can't get your 100%, you don't hit your protein or you don't hit your calories perfectly, or you don't get all your workouts or all your steps, that doesn't mean you can't achieve your goal. And that doesn't mean that you should round down to zero. If you get a flat tire, you don't slash your other three tires out. That's the sort of mentality. Instead of being a all or nothing person, be a make the best of it kind of person. It's in all likelihood, the goal that you have doesn't require perfection. And so in moments where you are not perfect, the point of this sentiment to me is don't round down to zero. Just air quote, get back on track. Just make your next meal a good one. Just get a workout in tomorrow. Just do what you can today, even if it's not perfect. And so I think it's about bringing up the floor of your efforts, even if you can't hit that ceiling, right? If you can't hit a 10, don't round down to zero. Do something, right? And there are so many iterations and different kind of applications of this mindset. To me, that's the one that jumps out to mind, where there is no goal that requires you to hit your calories every single day forever without ever messing up or ever going over, or hit your protein every single day without ever having less, or get a workout, you know, perfect workouts every single week without ever missing one, you know, getting your steps in every single day without ever missing one. There is no goal that requires that, right? What is required is you not quitting when you have a day that isn't perfect. And that's the mindset, I think, where consistency over perfection really shines. Next question. I was told by my fitness coach that I can't be a runner and lose weight. I should switch to walking. Thoughts on being an athlete and still being able to change your body? Yeah, I think, you know, if I was being harsh, if I was in a harsh mood, I'd be like, hey, ditch this coach. This is a really dog shit sentiment. This is just a terrible... I'm going to tell you in a second where this person's coming from, but if you were told this in such a blunt manner, then I would find a new coach who's going to describe things in a little bit more nuance. Being a runner and losing weight. So the question is, what about running might make losing weight harder? And there's really only one, maybe two things that come to mind. Number one is that doing higher intensity cardio, again, not for everyone, will make some people hungrier. And that increased hunger might actually offset the calories that you burn if you eat a lot of calories in response to that increased hunger. You know, walking tends to be a way, or let's just use low intensity cardio. Walking, you could do low intensity cardio on a Stairmaster or elliptical or a bike. It's all the same. We're just talking low intensity versus high intensity. Is a way where I'd say most people can increase their activity, increase their calories burned without the corresponding increase in hunger. Now, that's not true for everybody. If you go back and you listen to a podcast I did with Brian Borstein when we were talking about some of our racing, Brian and I have both recently increased our cardiovascular work a lot. And in doing so, also our high-intensity cardio. Doing a lot more running, he was doing a lot more biking. And he did not experience increased hunger. Like he said, he's like, I was trying so hard to eat everything in sight, but I kept losing weight. Right? He could not eat to keep up with his calories burned. Whereas I feel like I maintained my weight just fine, which means I was hungrier in more of a corresponding amount to the calories, extra calories I was burning. I have increased my activity like double in the last 8 months or so, and I've gained no weight. I'm not tracking calories, by the way. I'm just like eating, you know, air quote, intuitively, mindfully, and I've gained and lost no weight. And I know that I've been hungrier since I've been doing more activity. And it seems like, you know, with some effort, of course, that I've gotten hungrier in a corresponding amount to how many calories I was burning, and they've roughly offset each other. So I think that if, you know, you're struggling to lose weight because you're incredibly hungry all the time and that's causing you to eat more than you have prescribed for yourself and your current goals, and you're doing a lot of running, that there's a link there. But that doesn't mean stop running. That means, for starters, just start to be aware of that. Maybe that's something that you do need to modify, or maybe just bringing some awareness to it is enough for you to maybe modify your nutrition strategy to meet that. And frankly, maybe running less is something that's on the table if you've gone through this line of thinking and decided that this is something that's making you super hungry. But saying you can't lose weight while running is dumb. It's entirely untrue. there is no single best way to implement movement in an overall kind of like fat loss pursuit. And running can absolutely be a part of your pursuit of fat loss. I think acknowledging that maybe you are somebody that gets hungrier with higher intensity cardio, and maybe that's something to look at, should be part of a very open-ended discussion with you and your coach. This idea of like, you can't run and lose weight. But yeah, that's a very blanket statement that is untrue categorically, but also just deserves a lot of nuance. And so you can absolutely be an athlete, and we'll say be an athlete as a proxy for do high intensity cardio and lose body fat. You absolutely can. I think it's worth acknowledging that maybe you are getting hungrier from a lot of this high intensity work, and maybe that deserves addressing it, but maybe it doesn't. Maybe just bringing some awareness to it and saying, okay, I need to track calories if I'm not, you know, if you're trying to just go by your hunger cues, maybe that's not going to fly here because maybe you are a bit hungrier from this high intensity work. And again, maybe that means you should do less. Maybe not though. Maybe it just means, hey, maybe I have to track my calories because if I just rely on my hunger signaling, I'm going to eat quite a bit more with this high intensity work. Cool. Moving on. See, weird question. Do you like anyone at the moment? Well, I am coming up on my 1-year wedding anniversary, and I'm about to have a baby almost on the same day. And so, yes, I like somebody right now. Sorry. Next question. How would a lying overhead press differ versus a seated overhead press? Is lying going to be much harder in terms of weight used specifically in the mid-range? Lying overhead press? I'm not really sure how you're setting this up here. So lying down versus seated, do you mean lying down on a bench, but that bench is relatively upright? Like lying down on a 60-degree bench versus sitting upright with no backrest? Do you mean lying flat and doing an overhead press with... Jeez. I'm really not sure, I can guess here, but if you mean like lying on your stomach and then using dumbbells and pressing them overhead, do you mean lying down on your stomach and doing a cable press? Do you mean lying back on a bench that is roughly upright? Because you're calling both of these an overhead press, so I have to imagine that the bench that you're using is roughly upright. The other one is seated. Do you mean seated with no backrest? So I'm not really sure what you mean. If you mean a seated press with no backrest, or a seated overhead press with a bench where you're laying back and it's on a 60-degree-ish angle, which is like upright-ish, so you're pressing overhead-ish, you'll have more stability with the bench. I would recommend if you're trying to work the front delts that you lay back on a bench on roughly 60 degrees, sometimes a little higher, 75 degrees, sometimes a little bit lower, 45 degrees, but I would recommend using a bench. But that doesn't mean you can't ever do something like a barbell overhead press or a dumbbell overhead press where you're standing or sitting with no backrest. I think that there's, you know, other benefits to doing it that way. We're going to be doing that in our program coming up soon, an overhead press. But we're going to run a barbell overhead press for a couple of cycles in a row, which is fine. I think the optimal police might come in and say, well, you're better off doing a 60-degree seated dumbbell press. And I would say, hey, like, I hear you. We've done a 60-degree dumbbell press for the last 10 cycles in a row. We can't just keep doing that forever. You have to have alternatives. So hopefully that's helpful. Next question. On the hack squat machine, should the backrest be reclined or put more forward? On a hack squat machine, should the backrest be reclined or put more forward? So on an actual hack squat machine, you can't change the backrest. If you mean a linear hack squat machine or a leg press, for leg press, I like having the backrest all the way down. Having that backrest more up means you start in more hip flexion, which you might think is a good idea for glutes, but I just find that most people are more uncomfortable like that. It's usually not a big angular difference. The leg presses in commercial gyms don't have a ton of options usually in terms of backrest angle. If you're talking about a leg press, I like starting with the backrest all the way down and starting from there and seeing how it goes, using your foot placement to decide if you want to use a little bit more quads or more glutes. If you will use a lower foot position, more quads, higher foot position, more glutes. Certainly, if you're trying to work quads, put the seat all the way down. But even if you're trying to work glutes, I find that to be most comfortable for most people. If you're talking about a linear hack squat machine, like the one that I have in my home gym, the backrest needs to be all the way up all the time. Seriously, all the way up, all the way down. When I say, all the way down, all the way time, all the way down. All the time. the backrest should be as pushed forward as you can, because you need something to press into. And even if that means you start in a little bit more hip flexion, it is required, because there are no shoulder pads like you would have on a traditional hack squat. You need to be pressing into something. And the more angled down that backrest is, the better leverage, the more you can push into something, which is super valuable. I've tried it with the bench, kind of the backrest all the way up, and you just don't really have anything to push into. You have less to push into. So hopefully something was helpful there. How is a cut different from a diet? And can you go into cut details? How long should it last? When is the right time? So there's so much of this that is individualized. There's a ton of this answer that has to do with you and your preferences and your goals and your health status and your diet history and all of this stuff. So I think a cut and a diet, at least in the fitness industry, tends to be used interchangeably. You're going on a diet to lose weight is normally the end of that sentence, or you're cutting, which is to lose weight. And so they're used roughly interchangeably. I would say if we're just talking semantically, if I'm being a little bit pedantic here, a diet just means the food that you habitually eat, right? Going on a diet doesn't necessarily mean to lose weight. However, that is what people typically mean. Going into cut details, how long should it last? When is the right time? Again, super individual. How long should it last? There is no, I'll start with this. This whole like nutrition periodization of like, oh, you should be in a cut for this long and then maintenance this long and then diet break this long and diet break this many weeks for this much time and then you do a refeed. It's all made up. It's made up. We have enough research now between continuous energy restriction, which just means going into a deficit and staying in a deficit, versus taking diet breaks and refeeds and calorie cycling. It doesn't matter. There is no such thing as you have to take a break after this many weeks for this many weeks. There is no physiological reason to do that. However, psychologically, you might benefit from breaking up your deficit into phases. What those phases are is, again, totally nebulous, ambiguous, up to you. There is no physiological, scientific reason to break up your deficit. There might be practical and psychological appeals. Absolutely. You might, if I told you that you were going to need to be in a deficit for 24 weeks, right? And I said, well, you could do that in 24 weeks straight, which, by the way, I would never say that. There's no way to know that for sure, but let's use that as a hypothetical. 24 weeks in a deficit. You can either do that by doing 4 weeks on and 1 week off and doing six rounds, right? 6 rounds of 4 weeks on, 1 week off. That takes you 30 weeks for 24 weeks of dieting. Or you could do 12 weeks on, 2 weeks off, right? And so that would take you 14 weeks, 28 weeks to be in a deficit for 24 weeks. Or you could just stay in a deficit for 24 weeks. And again, every iteration, every different kind of permutation of that is possible. You could be in a deficit for 3 days and at maintenance for 1 day, 3 days, 1 day, 3 days, 1 day, or, you know, 5 days, 2 days at maintenance. Like it does not matter. What matters is what's going to make you the most successful when all is said and done. And so diet breaks are not an appeal to psychology or physiology. There's no better retention of lean mass. There's no better retention of resting metabolic rate. There's no like metabolic benefit to taking breaks. There isn't. But you might find that you or your clients, adhere better when they attack a large goal in smaller chunks. And they might be able to adhere better when they know 4 weeks from now, they get a little break. Or 2 weeks from now, they get a little break. Or 2 months from now, they get a little break. That might change the way they adhere to their deficit now because they know that there's a light at the end of the tunnel that comes a little bit sooner. But none of that is an appeal to better body composition change. It's an appeal to just human psychology and how we might perform better if we chop up a larger goal into smaller chunks. And again, that's not everybody. I've had people do amazingly well 6 months straight in a deficit. And every time we have a check-in or something, it's like, how are you doing? How are you feeling? Let's talk biofeedback. Is the juice worth the squeeze? If it is, there's no real reason you have to stop. If you go on a vacation or you feel really, really hungry and irritable and you feel like you're on the cusp of saying, F it, I don't want to do this anymore, then I think, yeah, absolutely. Considering getting out of the deficit, going to maintenance, maybe feeling a little bit better, isn't a bad plan. Next question. In a bulk, can you take weekly averages or is it important to be in a surplus every single day? So you absolutely can take weekly averages. And I take weekly averages with all my clients who are in a bulk. And I'm not worried about it one iota. Like, practically speaking, if you spend 5 days in a surplus and 2 days at maintenance, or 2 days in a cut and 5 days in surplus, I don't think over the course of four, six, eight, 12, 18 months, it's going to make any difference whatsoever. I think the average surplus over time is 95% or more what matters. I would say, though, if you can help it, like if you have all the freedom in the world to design this and you were really trying to get that last 5%, I'd say spend as few days in a deficit as you need. Like, don't spend a lot of days voluntarily in a catabolic state if your goal is to build maximum muscle over time. And how do you reconcile those two statements? By saying that I don't think it really matters much if you spend a couple days in a deficit here or there, if the average surplus over time is equal. But if you asked me, like, gun to head, you pin me down, you asked me to pick, which strategy I think really optimizes everything, I'd say spend as few days in a deficit as you can. If you have days at maintenance, no problem, man. You should be totally taking weekly averages. I've never had to micromanage this with a client. If you use a very extreme example and you're like, hey, I'm going to spend 6 days in a deficit and 1 day at 15,000 calories or something like that. Yeah, I think that's not going to lead to optimal results. But in a practical setting where the standard deviation that people go over and under is usually a bit small, it's not a huge thing. It's not like you're eating 2,000 calories more on one day and 2,000 calories less on another day. It's practical. It's a couple hundred extra here, a couple hundred less here, kind of maintenance here, a couple hundred more there. I really don't think it matters. I think you can rest easy, use weekly averages. Next question. Hi, I'm realizing it's suboptimal to work the same body part 2 days in a row. That's not necessarily true. If you have to do it a few times in the month due to scheduling, is it okay? Absolutely. Better than not lifting that second time? Absolutely. I don't think there's anything that says you can't work the same muscle group 2 days in a row. Because I'm not bothered by your question, but I think when people talk about times per week, what are you doing? If you do 3 sets of barbell rows on Monday, and then on Tuesday you need to do 3 sets of cable rows, you can absolutely do that. Your back will be fine. It's fine. I'd say it's the same as if you took Tuesday off and then on Wednesday you did your cable rows. It's the same. We got to add into this equation what you are doing. If you do a full leg day on Monday, 15 working sets, and you are absolutely smashed Tuesday morning, should you do another full leg day on Tuesday morning? You might be able to. It's probably not the best idea. But most people are so freaking worried about, like, oh, I did 2 exercises for my back yesterday. Like, I can't do my back tomorrow. It's like, you probably can. You know, I train full body right now. And every full body day, I work my entire body, either directly or indirectly. And sure, sometimes I do hack squats on Monday and I show up and I have split squats on Tuesday and my quads, they feel a little something. So what? It's fine. You can work through that. It's practical. I'm not even saying like you'll survive it. I'm saying don't worry about it so much. It's fine. You're going to make the same gains. Yes, don't obliterate one muscle and then obliterate it again the next day. Fine. But within reason here, if you're doing like upper lower split and you happen to have to do your 2 upper days back to back, it's fine. You're going to be fine. You know, we're missing the equation of what you do on that day. You said upper body sessions back to back. You're fine. You probably didn't do 12 sets of chest on Monday and you have to do another 12 on Tuesday. You probably did, 2 to 6 sets on Monday. Maybe you have 2 to 6 sets on Tuesday. You'll survive. You're going to be fine. That one always gets me not heated, but like, the discussion of frequency or like when you're training without the context of what you're doing, like what did you do on that day? What exercises, how many sets, how close to failure, how do you feel the next day, what's your nutrition like, really matters a ton. What's an easy way to know what your zone 2 heart rate is? Roughly 70% max heart rate, I think is fine. 60 to 70% max heart rate. I think that that's a totally fine way to go about it. I think using heart rate for zone 2 is fine, but I also think you should start to develop an understanding of what zone 2 feels like. Something like a talk test where you, for example, pick like a 15-word sentence or something, maybe say the Pledge of Allegiance. That's one I do with my clients. And if you can say the Pledge of Allegiance without needing to take a big gasp for air. That's a good sign you're still in zone two. From a understanding of, again, what zone two should feel like, if I call you on the phone and you pick up, you should be able to keep a conversation with me in zone two. If somebody walks up next to you on the treadmill and they want to have a chat while you're doing your zone two session, you should be able to have a conversation with them. But it should be stressed. What I mean by that is if I call you and you pick up the phone, you're in the middle of zone two, I should know that you are exercising, but you should be fine to keep a conversation with me. I went live on Instagram during one of my zone two sessions to really test this out, to answer some questions. And it really reinforced this for me. We're like, I can do that. I can go, when I'm in zone two, I can go live on Instagram and I can answer questions. But it's not comfortable. I don't love it. I'd rather not be doing it. And so I would rather, instead of heart rate, I think heart rate ballpark for most people, it's going to be like in the 120 to 150, right? Again, that's a wide range, but I think that that's the point. The point is zone two technically isn't a heart rate. Doing a talk test and conceptualizing whether or not you could keep a conversation is actually more related to what zone two actually is. The upper end of zone two is called your ventilatory threshold. The upper end of zone two is the point at which you shift to burning more carbohydrates and producing more CO2, and your breathing has to speed up and speed up rapidly. And so the talk test and your ability to maintain a conversation is actually more specific to what zone two actually is. And so get yourself in a ballpark heart rate, right? Ballpark heart rate, and then use the talk test, you know, an idea of what ventilatory threshold feels like. Can you hold a conversation? You know, I'll have my clients take a recording of them saying the Pledge of Allegiance to me, and I'll pay attention to what their breathing sounds like. How fast are they breathing? How deep are they breathing? How many words can they get in before they have to take a deep breath in? That's more important to me for zone two. Next question. Do you ever not want to go to the gym? Are there times when you'd prefer to stay on the couch? How do you push past this? Yeah, absolutely. My motivation to train has been the lowest it's been in my entire life the last couple of years. Mostly because I have no real goals in terms of getting any bigger. I'm mostly just lifting for maintenance and health. And so I have that quite a bit. I will say it's different. My gym is in my garage. I have nice equipment for a home gym. And so I've reduced the friction by a lot. My gym is in my garage and it's, you know, I have equipment I enjoy using. And so those excuses of like it, that extra friction of having to drive to the gym, or you don't love your gym, there's other people there, whatever, that's not there for me. So I will say that that's something I've done to reduce the friction. When it comes to like losing motivation in the gym, most people are losing motivation in the gym for one of two reasons. They're either doing something they don't love, a type of training, or they're doing that type of training too much that they don't have room for other stuff they like in their life. So most people that are losing motivation for the gym are either doing a type of training that they don't love, or they're doing it too much and they're not filling other time with stuff they really do like. So a lot of these people are like training four or five, six days a week and would all of a sudden love going to the gym if they only went two, three, four times a week. I'll tell you right now, I love my training these days, training 3 days a week. I look forward to my lifts more than I did maybe a couple of years ago when I was training 4 or 5 days a week, because I'm training 3 days a week. You know, it's not just like absence makes the heart grow fonder. It's just that I'm not getting sick of it because I'm not doing it as often. And because I'm doing it less, what I've done is I've spent that time that I got back on other things that I do like, which is right now my cardio, my work, soon being dad, all that stuff. And so I would sit with that. I'd say, well, could I do less than I'm doing right now? Could I drop a day from what I'm doing? You probably could. And as long as you're doing at least 3 days a week, I'd bet you're still doing enough to grow, to see progress, to build muscle. And if you do decide to do less, maybe think about what you want to do with that extra time. You'll enjoy your workouts more if you enjoy your life more. I know that that's a little vague, kind of a weird idealistic thing to say, but like I like my lifts more because I also have, you know, the cardio aspect of what I'm doing, because I also have free time to play with my dogs and, you know, time to spend on my work. Like I'm not resenting my workouts anymore for taking me away from other stuff I want to do because I've reduced the amount I'm doing them. You know, a lot of it is I don't have that motivation to train because there's a low-lying subconscious resentment because I'd rather be doing X. That isn't always the case, and it's not so clear what X is, but I think a lot of people are training more than they would like or doing what slash doing more of what they don't or lacking a thing they would really like to include but feel like they can't because they don't want to train less. And I'm here to tell you, if you're training 4 or 5 days a week, you could train 2, 3, 4 times a week and either maintain or grow if you're doing 3 to 4 times a week and have room for other stuff. And I think that that, for a lot of people, is a way to enjoy your training more, is to not let it consume your life with 5 times a week, 2 hours, you know? Next question, who's your crush? At JM Lips Fitness. Next, how to develop the neurological drive to push to failure? Sometimes I fail, not because I'm tired or because it burns, but because it's like my brain won't let me push. No. So you said it's hard to explain. It's not hard to explain. You're explaining it perfectly. Two things come to mind for me. Number one is try and develop that drive to push to failure in exercises that lend themselves better to that. And what I mean by that is high stability exercises, machines, single joint movements are going to be easier for you to push really close to and maybe even beyond failure. It's easier to push yourself hard to fail in a leg extension than it is to push yourself hard to fail in a back squat. A back squat is way more complex, has way more moving parts and joints. It's way more technical. You have way more a risk of having a technique breakdown. And so I would work on this neurological drive to push to failure and actually practice slash going to failure more frequently on your high stability machine exercises, chest supported stuff, isolation, single joint movements. That's where you should really lock in this drive to push to failure. On your RDLs, on your back squats, it's going to be a little bit trickier. There's more moving parts, more opportunities for technique breakdown. It's not going to be as clear where failure is. The second thing is rest a little bit longer. So when you're resting for hypertrophy or for performance, you need to make sure that, like, one of the things that people forget is to rest long enough to feel ready again to push hard. That's a little bit nebulous, but sometimes I'll see my alarm go off after 2 minutes or whatever, and it's time to go again. And let's say I'm doing a chest supported row. My back, my biceps, my arms, my grip, they all feel ready to go again. My cardiovascular system feels ready to go. But neurologically, I look at the bench, I'm looking at the cable stack, and I'm just like, you know what? I'm not yet ready to go dive deep into that, you know, effort hole again right now. And so maybe rest an extra minute, and you might find that neurologically, from a fatigue perspective, from a state of readiness perspective, you feel more ready to push hard. I find that when I don't rest long enough, and again, it's funny because right now we're doing a lot of short rest periods in my training, in my group program, but we're doing it on movements that aren't neurologically taxing, that aren't cardiovascularly taxing, that don't have a lot of synergist muscle contribution. And so I would recommend resting a little bit longer. I think people underrate that state of readiness fatigue that happens from a hard set. RDLs, I rest for like 5 minutes between sets of RDLs. My hamstrings, glutes, low back are probably ready after 3 minutes. My cardiovascular system's probably ready after about 3 minutes. But I need another minute or two just to like conceive and get my mind wrapped around the fact that I have to do this again. And that sounds maybe, I don't know, like a wussy sort of attitude or like, you know, just get in there and do it. But like, I think if you've trained really hard, you know what I'm talking about, where like you might, from a muscular and cardiovascular system perspective, feel ready to go. But mentally, you're like, I really just need another minute. I can't go back into that state of mind just yet. And so hopefully some of that was helpful. What do we have? 40, 34 minutes. What do we got? Five. We'll go through five more. You have had quite a bit of guests on your podcast. After having someone on your podcast, have you felt yourself changing your mind about them, positive or negative, after speaking with them? Yeah, all the time. I say that because that's natural. Most of the people I have on my podcast, I've gotten to know through their content, and that's different than having a face-to-face conversation with them. And so I'd say every time but that's just like, it's like reading someone's biography and then meeting them. It's like, you're going to shift how you feel about them in some way based on, you have a new perspective of who they are based on your interactions with them in a different environment. This happens to me every single time. I'm certainly not going to give examples of maybe even the negative side, but that's absolutely happened. I don't think I've ever had somebody on the podcast and be like, wow, this person sucks, you know, because I think a lot of people do a good job genuinely displaying who they are in their content, and then getting on a podcast, they're not drastically different. And so I have a decent idea of who's coming on the podcast, what we're going to talk about, what their kind of vibe is, what their personality's like. I'd say 99.999% of the time, I grow to like that person even more. I can think of one where, I can think of one, and I'll be annoying and tease the fact that it was a pretty big name where I didn't, it's not that I didn't love them as a person, but I just think that they went on about a piece of rhetoric about, let's just say, like how much more building muscle helps you burn calories at rest, and, you know, how much, you know, you should build muscle because it boosts your metabolism and all this stuff. Just went off on that. Wasn't my favorite, but yeah, whatever. I think that this absolutely happens. The answer is 100% unequivocally yes. When in a rush, what's left on the table moving from 3 sets to 2 in a 4 times per week push-pull leg split? Facing this more frequently and trying to remain calm. Well, I'll tell you, you probably get north of 70% of the benefits of an exercise doing the first set, probably close to 90%, maybe 80 to 90% from doing the second set, and maybe that last 10 to 20% from doing that third set. And so probably not much. And I would say whether you do, and again, I don't know how many exercises you're doing. I don't know what exercises you're doing. I don't know how close you're going to failure. Like, you're like, I'm doing a push-pull legs, and the first day I do 1 set of push-ups, and the second day I do 1 set of pull-ups, and the last day I do 1 set of squats. That's a push-pull leg split. You know, like, you know, I don't even know what a 4-day push-pull leg split is. Are you doing push-pull legs push, and then the next week pull legs push-pull? Whatever. Like, I don't know what you're doing. I don't know how many exercises. I don't know which exercises you're doing. But I'm imagining a very standard workout of 4 to 6 exercises, 2 to 4 sets, mostly compounds. Like, I'm imagining a basic, standard design program, but I don't know. And so that's, you know, you might be doing a bunch of short position work, 2 to 3 exercises per workout, and the workouts take you 25 minutes. Now taking that down from 3 to 2 might be the difference between growing and not growing. I'm imagining, though, if you're doing 4 to 6 exercises per workout, you know, in this case, 2 sets of everything, close to failure, I bet you you're still well, when I say this, I mean it with emphasis, well beyond the threshold needed to make gains, like well above the threshold needed to make gains, such that I would not be so worried about this or worried about it at all. That's way more than I'm training. Not that it matters for me, but like 4 times a week, maybe 8 to 12 working sets, dude, you're killing it. Go close to failure, pick smart exercises, eat enough calories and protein, sleep enough hours, you're good. Remain calm. Next, another reputable source just had a couple posts stating that as you age, you require more protein. What's your take on this? The answer is yes. Basically, as we get older, probably like north of 60, 65, but probably progressively as we age, we undergo what's called anabolic resistance. When you eat protein, the point of that protein or the amino acids is to stimulate what's called muscle protein synthesis, which just means the synthesis or creation of muscle proteins or muscle. And so we eat protein because it stimulates muscle protein synthesis, and those amino acids help us build more muscle tissue and other tissues in the body also. When we get older, we need more protein to get the same muscle protein synthetic response. And so maybe I'll give just an example, ballpark numbers here. Don't use these, just understand it as a like way of thinking. Maybe when you were 20, you'd eat 40 grams of protein and you would get a really robust muscle protein synthetic response. When you're 65, in order to get that same muscle protein synthetic response, maybe you need to have 50 or 60 grams of protein at a single meal to get that same response. And so what does this mean? It means as you become a grandparent, you know, as you get your AARP card, like maybe it's time to really make sure you're getting a full bolus of protein at each meal, you know, somewhere in that 30 to 60 grams per meal range to make sure you're getting that maximum or near maximum, or I don't think it's actually maximum, but let's say near maximum or very high amount of muscle protein synthetic response per meal. What I do think, though, is that within the fitness industry, air quotes, we recommend generally really a ton of protein, a ton of protein. You know, I am on the low end of protein recommendations, saying like 1.4 to 1.6 grams per kg is like plenty. That's like 0.66 to 0.75 grams per pound. I am of the opinion that that's plenty to maximize muscle growth. That's plenty for people. I think if you're already doing that, that this is less of an issue. You know, like to say that it becomes more important as you age is true, but if you're already eating 0.7 grams per pound or more, splitting that up over, you know, three or more meals, like you're doing a great job. The thing that I always think of when I think of anabolic resistance is people who aren't eating enough protein already, but are like getting by because they're a little younger. And then when they age, that what happens is we actually see that calories go down and appetite goes down, calorie intake goes down, and typically the macronutrient that suffers the most when you get older and your appetite goes down is protein. So people eat even less protein when they get older. And so if I was working with somebody in this age bracket, I would start by just making sure they get at least one meal with a high amount of protein, you know, in that 40 plus, hopefully even more than that in a single meal. And so that's more of where I think about this is people that already aren't eating enough protein, when they do age, appetite goes down, typically calories come down. Listen, what do you eat when you're, what are you hungry for when you're not that hungry? I'll tell you what you're not hungry for is chicken breast. So when you have a lower appetite, you tend to also have a less of an appetite for protein. And so we see calories go down, we see protein intake go down. You know, those are also some of the reasons that we see, you know, losses in lean mass, losses in strength. And so I think those are the people that I really want to speak to right now, not the people that are already freaking eating a gram per pound or, you know, 0.7 grams per pound. Like, you guys are already doing great. You probably don't need to think about this. Just keep doing that and keep trying to do that as you age, and maybe your natural proclivity to want to eat protein maybe goes down. Keep doing what you're doing. But to people who are already not eating a lot of protein and then appetite goes down, and the appetite for protein is the thing that usually goes down the most, that's to whom I'd want to talk about this with. We'll go last two. Do you watch Doctor Who? I have no idea what that is. Last question. What a waste of that second to last one. Is it okay to drop weight during a set? Some weeks I am not as strong as the previous week. I wouldn't do this. You could. Most of the time, like if you did a 50-pound dumbbell row last week for a set of eight, I highly doubt you don't have the experience of going up, grabbing that 50-pound dumbbell and being like, oh no, I can't even do any reps. Like usually this drop in performance week to week is very minimal. You're like, well, I can't do eight reps with the 50, so I should just go do something else. I'll go grab the 45 or the 40. Don't do that. Just to me, I think these drops in performance are so minuscule that I would just want, just, okay, you drop a rep, go get the 50, do seven reps. It's not a big deal. You know, next week, go back for eight or nine reps. Like your performance will fluctuate week to week a little bit sometimes. But yeah, it's fine for you to do that. But I just think that normally these drops in performance are small enough that you could probably use the same weight. Maybe you don't beat your performance from last week. Maybe you just match it. Maybe you drop a rep. And so I don't think I would recommend this as your first line of defense here. But if you like, And the thing is, so if you have a performance decrement, a decrease in performance that's very subtle, like I'm talking about, maybe you did 50 for eight, now you're doing 50 for seven, I want you to do that. But if you do go into the gym and you did 50 for eight last week and you pick up the 50 and you can only do two, then you need to deload. Go home. Like if the performance decrease is massive, that you must decrease the weight because you can't even do any reps with the weight that you did last week, go home. You need to deload. You at the very least shouldn't be at the gym right now, right? You're so fatigued, so tired, so stressed that you can't even do like a couple reps with the weight you did last week. Go home. So it's unlikely the case that this is what I would do, but in the nuance, in the weeds, yeah, it's fine. But I just feel like if you have a tiny performance decrease, which is more likely the case, all right, you get a rep or two less, no big deal. If you have a huge performance decrease that you can't even do any reps with that same weight, I would just go home. So, yeah. And you're not going to be the exact same strength every week. Even if you try and progress week to week, even if you are able to progress a little bit every week, most weeks. It won't happen every single week. And so, and frankly, I don't want to go on a rant on this, but you don't have to progress every week. You know, I encourage my trainees to try to progress a tiny bit every week, but it's the trying to progress that I care about. A workout that you do today that's really hard, a really hard workout that you do today is still above the threshold needed to make gains for the next couple of months. If you do a set of 8 and it was really hard today, you could keep going in the gym and doing that same exact set of 8. And I bet you for the next 4 to 8 weeks, it's still well within the threshold needed to make gains, make progress. So yeah, there's also that. So that wasn't the exact question. Cool. Let's put a pin in that right on 45 minutes. Look at us go here. Thank you to everybody who asked a question. I will see you guys in the next one.
Thanks for tuning in to this episode of Where Optimal Meets Practical. If you liked the episode, it would mean the world to me if you posted a screenshot to your social media or left a 5-star review on iTunes. That stuff really helps. If you ever want to get in touch with me, just shoot me a DM on Instagram @JordanLipsFitness. I'm always around to chat. Thanks, guys. Have a good one.